So I want you to take a map of the world. Like, just picture one in your mind right now. Look at the coastlines of the continents, the little specks of the islands out in the Pacific. We really treat those lines separating the land from the water as, permanent.
Right, like their geology.
Exactly. They're solid, fixed realities that we base literally our entire global civilization on. But if you look at the latest oceanographic data we've got, that map is already broken. I mean, those lines are moving, and they are moving incredibly fast.
Yeah, it really forces a complete mental shift, doesn't it? We're watching the physical geography of the planet being rewritten, basically in real time. And, well, we have to start with the most immediate, unignorable data that just came out.
Right, the new UN report.
Exactly. So as of June 2026, the United Nations released its Third World Ocean Assessment. And the headline, the thing everyone is talking about, is that the rate of global sea level rise has roughly doubled over just the past 10 years alone.
Doubled in a decade. I mean, that's the kind of statistic that forces you to just stop and recalibrate your entire understanding of the timeline here.
It really is. The UN actually used the phrase severe stress to describe the state of the oceans, pointing to the immediate vulnerability of global coastal populations. And what makes that doubling rate even more critical is a corresponding study that was published in March of 2026 by the Associated Press and The Guardian.
Right, I read that one.
Yeah, so that research revealed that our historical baseline assessments have actually been drastically underestimating real-world sea levels. Because of poor modeling, specifically regarding coastal elevations in the global south, the water is already higher and reaching further inland than we thought.
Wow.
So tens of millions more people are at risk today than the projections from just, a few years ago assumed.
So we have this terrifying intersection of realities here, right? Like the water is rising significantly faster than it used to, and our baseline understanding of where the water was supposed to be was too conservative to begin with.
Exactly. We were measuring from the wrong starting line.
Which brings us to our mission for this deep dive. We really want to cut through the abstract noise today and understand exactly how this physical reality is operating. We're going to understand the mechanical science of the swelling oceans, the acceleration driven by collapsing ice, the tools we use to predict the unpredictable, and finally, what this actually looks like on the ground for communities and global health.
Because treating this as a slow, futuristic sci-fi scenario of a city underwater in the year 2100 is, well, it's no longer scientifically valid. It is a present-day physical reality.
Right.
To understand how houses are actively falling into the ocean right now, we have to start with the fundamental physics. We really have to look at the engines driving the ocean.
Okay, let's unpack this because when I hear sea level rise, my brain immediately goes to like melting glaciers. But based on the sources from NASA and NOAA, that's really only half of the equation, right? There are two primary engines here, and the first one doesn't actually involve new water being added to the ocean at all.
Right. That's the concept of thermal expansion. And for a long time, it was actually the dominant driver of the sea level rise we were observing. It just comes down to the basic properties of water when it absorbs heat.
Basic physics.
Exactly. The world's oceans act as an immense planetary heat sink. They absorb the vast majority, we're talking over 90% of the excess heat trapped in our atmosphere by greenhouse gases. So as the water absorbs this heat, its overall temperature rises.
And when water heats up, its density changes. I mean, we are talking about the literal kinetic energy of the water molecules, right?
Yes.
As the temperature rises, the molecules get more energetic, they move around more rapidly, and they essentially just require more elbow room. It's kind of like a massive crowd of people suddenly going from standing still to dancing. The crowd naturally spreads out and takes up more physical space, even though the number of people hasn't changed at all.
That is an excellent way to conceptualize it. The mass of the water remains exactly the same, but the volume expands. When you apply that physical property to the incomprehensible volume of the global ocean, that microscopic increase in the space between molecules translates to a measurable rise in the sea level globally.
Which is wild. But then we have the second engine, which is the one that gets all the headlines, obviously the melting of land-based ice. This is the addition of entirely new mass to the ocean basin.
Exactly. We are talking about mountain glaciers across the globe, from the Himalayas to the Alps, and of course, the massive continental ice sheets covering Greenland and Antarctica. As the atmosphere and the surrounding oceans warm, this ice melts and physically flows into the sea. But a crucial distinction has to be made here, which is frequently misunderstood by the public.
Yeah.
This was highlighted by researchers at antarcticglaciers.org. You really have to separate land-based ice from sea ice.
Right, because sea ice is already floating in the water. So if the sea ice at the North Pole melts, it doesn't actually raise the sea level because it's already displacing its own weight in the water.
Exactly. It operates on Archimedes' principle. The flowing ice is already part of the ocean's volume. Think of it like ice cubes melting in a glass of water. The water level in the glass doesn't go up when the ice melts.
It stays exactly the same.
Right. But the glaciers and the massive ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica are sitting on bedrock.
Yeah.
They're locked up on land. So when they melt, or when massive chunks break off and slide into the ocean, that is entirely new volume being introduced into the basin.
So thermal expansion is like a pot of soup bubbling up and expanding when you heat it, while melting land ice is like dropping extra ice cubes into a glass that's already completely full.
That's a perfect analogy, yeah.
So those are the two engines driving the relentless long-term upward trend. But looking at the NASA data, the line on the graph isn't a perfectly smooth slope. There are jagged peaks and valleys. I remember reading that global sea levels spiked dramatically in 2023, but then a NASA Jet Propulsion Lab analysis from early 2026 showed that the rise temporarily slowed down or dipped in 2025.
Yes, that's true.
But wait, if the UN is saying the rate has doubled, but NASA says the sea level actually dipped in 2025, how is anyone supposed to trust these models? I mean, that sounds like a contradiction to a layperson.
It totally does sound contradictory on the surface.
Yeah.
But it's actually a perfect illustration of how short-term natural climate variability overlays the long-term human-driven trend. The planet's climate system is highly dynamic.
Right.
The NASA analysis explains that the spike we saw in 2023 was supercharged by a strong El Niño event. And during an El Niño, global atmospheric circulation shifts in a way that alters where precipitation falls. It tends to bring much heavier rainfall over the open oceans and less over the continents.
Okay, so the water that would normally be trapped in lakes, soils, rivers, and aquifers on land is instead just being dumped directly into the ocean basin.
Precisely. You are transferring massive amounts of water mass from the continents to the sea. And conversely, the dip, or slowdown, observed in 2025 was driven by a La Niña event. La Niña effectively reverses that rainfall pattern.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it causes massive amounts of moisture to evaporate from the ocean and fall as heavy rain and snow over the landmasses. So for a period of months or even a year, the continents are holding on to more water, temporarily limiting the volume of the ocean.
So the ocean is sort of breathing in and out based on these weather patterns. The 2025 dip didn't mean thermal expansion stopped or the glacier stopped melting. It just meant a massive amount of water was temporarily parked on the continents as snow or rain.
Exactly. And once that water makes its way back down the rivers, the relentless baseline rise reasserts itself.
Got it. But understanding that baseline rise brings up a major misconception I want to ask you about. I think a lot of people operate under what we could call the giant bathtub myth.
Oh, absolutely.
Like if I fill my bathtub at home, the water is perfectly flat and level across the entire surface. Why wouldn't a rising ocean just evenly distribute the water across every coast in the world?
That bathtub analogy is honestly one of the most dangerous misconceptions we have.
Yeah.
Because it leads coastal planners to dramatically underestimate local risks. The ocean is not flat.
Wait, really? Not flat at all?
Not at all. The reality is what oceanographers call sterodynamic sea level. It means the local sea level rise can differ wildly from the global average due to a complex web of dynamic forces. First, you have the sheer mechanics of ocean circulation.
You mean the ocean currents?
Yes. The ocean is in constant motion. Massive currents driven by prevailing winds, the rotation of the earth, and differences in water density are constantly pushing water around the globe. This dynamic motion literally causes water to pile up higher against certain coastlines and sit lower against others.
Oh, wow.
And as climate change alters atmospheric temperatures and wind patterns, those massive currents are shifting, which redistributes exactly where that water piles up.
That makes a lot of sense. It's like the wind blowing across the surface of a pond, physically pushing the water higher on one edge.
Exactly.
But there was another sterodynamic factor detailed in the NASA FAQ that completely broke my brain. The concept of ice sheet fingerprints. I need you to explain the mechanics of this because it sounds like literal science fiction.
It really is one of the most counterintuitive phenomena in Earth science. You have to consider the sheer mind-boggling mass of the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica.
Right.
We are talking about millions of cubic miles of dense ice.
Right.
They are so massive that they exert their own localized gravitational pull. Mm-hmm. They literally warp the gravitational field of the Earth around them.
The ice has so much mass that it is acting like a magnet for the ocean water.
That is the perfect way to grasp it. The gravitational pull of the Antarctic ice sheet literally pulls ocean water toward it. So the sea level is naturally significantly higher in the immediate vicinity of Antarctica because the water is being physically held there by the gravity of the ice.
Okay.
But what happens when that ice sheet melts?
It loses mass. And if it loses mass, it loses its gravitational pull.
Exactly. As the ice melts, its gravitational grip on the surrounding ocean weakens. The massive bulge of water that was being held against the coast of Antarctica is released, and it sloshes away, redistributing across the globe.
That's crazy.
So paradoxically, if a massive section of Antarctica melts, the sea level might actually drop near Antarctica, but that water surges away and causes sea level rise to spike significantly faster than the global average on distant shores like the east coast of the United States.
That is staggering. So the melting of a specific ice sheet leaves a unique fingerprint of sea level rise across the globe. We get hammered in North America precisely because the ice in Antarctica is no longer heavy enough to hold its own water back.
That's exactly it. And that stereodynamic complexity, the shifting currents, the localized thermal expansion from heat pockets, and the gravitational fingerprints. That is why a city planner cannot simply look at a global average number and know what to expect.
Right, because their local number might be way worse.
Exactly. But there is another catastrophic compounding factor that has nothing to do with the water itself. To understand the true local impact, we have to look at what the physical land is doing.
You're talking about subsidence, the sinking of the ground itself.
Yes. The NASA regional sea level overviews emphasize that in many of the world's most populous coastal areas, the land is physically sinking while the ocean is rising. This creates a deeply compounded relative sea level rise.
Right.
And while some of this is due to natural tectonic plate movement, or the slow, multi-millennial settling of land masses following the last ice age, a massive portion of modern subsidence is entirely human-driven.
Let's drill into the mechanics of that. How does a city physically sink? I know groundwater extraction is a major culprit, but what is actually happening beneath the street level?
Think of the ground beneath a coastal city, especially cities built on river deltas, as a hard sponge. It is made of layers of clay, sediment, and porous rock. Those pores are filled with groundwater, and that water is actually under pressure, helping to hold up the structural integrity of the soil layers above it. It acts as a foundational support.
So when a massive metropolitan area pumps millions of gallons of that groundwater up to the surface for drinking or industry or agriculture, they are emptying the pores in that geological sponge.
Exactly. When you remove the water pressure, the heavy layers of clay and sediment above simply compress. The pore spaces collapse.
Huh.
And here is the truly devastating part. It is largely irreversible.
Wow.
Once those sediment layers compact, you cannot just pump water back into the ground and inflate the city back up. The land drops permanently.
We see this with oil and gas abstraction too, right? You remove massive volumes of fluid from beneath the earth and the crust settles.
Yes, exactly the same principle.
So you have a city that is pumping its aquifers dry, causing the ground to physically drop by inches or even feet over a few decades, while simultaneously the ocean is expanding from heat and surging toward them due to the weakening gravity of distant melting ice.
It's a vice grip.
The gap between the ocean and the street level is closing at terrifying speed from both directions.
And this convergence of forces explains the historical rise we've seen. But as we discussed at the very beginning with the UN data, the timeline has suddenly shifted into overdrive. The steady, measurable rise we mapped in the 20th century is gone. We are entering an era of radical acceleration.
Let's explore that acceleration because the numbers are stark. Looking at the NASA Earth data and a major study published in Communications Earth and Environment in late 2024, they tracked the global mean sea level via satellite. From 1993 to 2024, the rate of rise more than doubled.
Right.
And then the UN warned in 2026 that it had effectively doubled again in the 10 years prior. Why is the engine suddenly running so much faster?
It is entirely driven by what scientists refer to as the cryosphere crisis. The cryosphere is the total sum of Earth's frozen water, and we are witnessing catastrophic accelerating losses across these regions. Let's look at a February 2025 Guardian study regarding mountain glaciers.
Okay.
They found that melting glaciers alone contributed almost 2 centimeters to global sea level rise just within this century.
Now, to someone sitting in a high-rise office building, 2 centimeters sounds like nothing, like a puddle. But if you take 2 centimeters of water and stretch it out to cover the surface area of the entire global ocean, which is 70% of the Earth's surface, the sheer tonnage of newly added water is almost incomprehensible.
Oh, we are talking about hundreds of billions of tons of newly liquid water. The pace of glacier loss is accelerating due to prolonged global warming. A stark warning was issued in November 2023, stating that if global temperatures warm near 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, we will trigger the irreversible loss of the majority of the world's mountain ice.
Which is terrifying.
It is. But while glaciers are contributing significantly right now, the true existential threat lies in the massive continental ice sheets, specifically the terrifying discoveries being made in Antarctica.
Antarctica really is the sleeping giant here, but it is so vast and remote that it often feels disconnected from our daily lives. The data from the British Antarctic Survey, however, shows that changes deep beneath that ice are what will ultimately drown coastal cities.
Yes. To understand the vulnerability of Antarctica, you have to understand the geography hidden beneath miles of ice. Much of the West Antarctic ice sheet does not sit on land that is above sea level.
Wait, really?
Yeah. It is resting on bedrock that is highly irregular, and crucially, much of that bedrock actually slopes downward as you move inland from the coast. It forms a massive deep bowl situated below sea level.
So the ice is filling a submarine bowl. The only reason the ocean isn't filling that space is because the massive volume of the ice sheet is displacing the water and pushing out into the sea, forming those giant floating ice shelves along the coast.
Exactly. Those floating ice shelves act as physical buttresses, holding back the unimaginable weight of the grounded ice behind them. But in June 2024, the British Antarctic Survey confirmed the mechanics of a new, devastating tipping point regarding what happens at the grounding line, the exact point where the ice sheet leaves the bedrock and begins to float.
What exactly did they find at that grounding line?
They found that warming ocean water is not just melting the front of the floating ice shells. It is physically seeping beneath the grounded Antarctic ice. Because the bedrock slopes downward inland, the warm, dense seawater is flowing deep into that subglacial bowl.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it is melting the ice sheet from the bottom up, completely undercutting its structural foundation.
And because it is melting from underneath, the grounding line is forced further and further inland, retreating down the slope into deeper and deeper water.
That is the core mechanism of marine ice sheet instability. As the warm water melts the ice from below, the ice sheet detaches from the bedrock and floats. This exposes even thicker sections of the inland ice to the warm water, which causes it to melt faster, which forces the grounding line even further down the slope.
It creates an unstoppable runaway feedback loop.
Exactly.
Oh, well.
Older climate models severely underestimated this risk because they didn't account for the specific mechanism of warm water infiltrating deep beneath the grounding line and eroding the friction that holds the ice to the rock.
That perfectly contextualizes the October 2023 Reuters report covering research that warned a meltdown of the West Antarctic ice sheet may now be completely unavoidable this century. The mechanism has already been triggered. The warm water is already in the bowl.
It's a profound realization for the scientific community. Even if we drastically and immediately cut global carbon emissions, the thermal inertia of the ocean means that warm water will continue to erode the underbelly of West Antarctica. The physical geometry of that bedrock slope makes the retreat incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to halt once the intrusion begins.
Now, this is where the conversation often jumps to extremes, and I want to clarify something for you, the listener. You see headlines in the popular press screaming, if Antarctica melts, sea levels rise by 200 feet.
Right, you see that everywhere.
And the immediate mental image is a massive continent-swallowing tidal wave hitting New York or London next Tuesday. How do we separate the theoretical extremes from the human timescale reality of what we are actually going to face?
It is a critical distinction. And the researchers at AntarcticGlaciers.org spend a lot of time addressing this specific panic. When you hear a number like 200 feet or roughly 58 meters, that refers to the sea level equivalent of the entire Antarctic ice sheet. It is a mathematical calculation. If every single molecule of ice in Antarctica instantly vanished, the ocean would rise by that amount.
But physics doesn't allow a continent of ice to instantly vaporize.
Exactly. The total sea level equivalent is a theoretical maximum, not a projection for our lifetimes. Melting millions of cubic miles of ice requires an astronomical transfer of thermal energy, and that takes a very, very long time. We are not facing a sudden apocalyptic tidal wave.
Okay, so we aren't looking at 200 feet tomorrow, but what are we actually looking at? If the West Antarctic tipping point is crossed, what is the locked-in reality for the coming centuries?
We are looking at a locked-in, multi-century commitment to rising seas that will fundamentally alter global coastlines. A February 2023 Axios report highlighted warnings that the current trajectory of ice sheet melt will drive continuous, unrelenting sea level rise for centuries to come. The water will keep rising long after our lifetimes. However, that does not mean our current actions are meaningless. An October 2025 Carbon Brief study modeled long-term outcomes and showed that rapid deep cuts to global emissions today could avoid up to 64 centimeters of that locked-in rise by the year 2300.
64 centimeters. That is over 2 feet of water. So we are essentially negotiating the pace of our own geographical retreat.
That is the perfect way to frame it. The water is going to rise, but the pace is the difference between adaptation and collapse. If the ocean rises 1 foot over 300 years, human civilization can adapt. We can slowly elevate infrastructure, alter agricultural practices, and migrate away from the coasts.
Right, but if it happens fast.
Exactly. If the ocean rises 1 foot over 30 years, our engineering, economic, and political systems will shatter under the strain. And because the physics of this ice melt are so incredibly complex, with warm water creeping under bedrock miles beneath the ice, projecting the exact pace is incredibly difficult.
Which means the scientists, the city planners, and the insurance companies desperately need ways to visualize these risks. I mean, if this ice is behaving in ways that defy our older, simpler physics models, how on earth is a city council in coastal New Jersey supposed to know how high to build a new seawall?
This is where the translation of raw science into actionable data becomes paramount. We have seen the development of highly sophisticated visualization toolkits designed to bridge that gap. The NASA IPCC AR6 Sea Level Projection Tool is a phenomenal example.
Okay, how does that work?
It takes the deeply complex projections from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and allows users to look at global and regional maps. You can actually toggle between different future human emissions scenarios.
So a local government can look at a map and say, here is our coastline if the world aggressively decarbonizes, and here is our coastline if we keep burning fossil fuels at the current rate.
Exactly. It visualizes the consequences of our policy choices. Similarly, NOAA has developed the Sea Level Rise Viewer, an interactive tool primarily for the United States that lets you zoom in to a granular neighborhood level to visualize local flood exposure under different increments of sea level rise.
That's super useful.
And independent organizations like Climate Central offer their surging seas analysis and global mapping tools, which are vital for translating this data for the general public.
But the data feeding into these interactive maps is staggering. I was reading the NASA explainers about how they actually gather the raw numbers to build these models. They rely on the GRACE and GRACE follow-on satellites. And these satellites aren't just taking pictures of the ice, they're literally weighing the ice sheets from space.
The GRACE satellites are an engineering marvel. GRACE stands for Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment. They operate in pairs, flying in constant formation. As they pass over a massive landform like the Greenland ice sheet, the gravitational pull of that mass slightly tugs on the leading satellite, changing the distance between the two probes by a fraction of a hair's breadth.
That's insane. So as the ice melts and runs into the ocean, the mass of Greenland decreases, its gravitational pull weakens, and the satellites detect that microscopic change in the pull.
Yes. They are mapping gravitational anomalies to calculate, with stunning precision, exactly how many gigatons of ice are being lost every single month. These visualization tools take that raw gravitational data from space, combine it with local stereodynamic factors like ocean currents, and overlay it onto topographic maps of the coast.
It is like having a hyper-advanced weather app, but instead of telling you if it is going to rain this afternoon, it is telling you if the main street of your hometown will be subjected to permanent inundation by the time your children are ready to inherit your house.
Precisely.
And tools like Climate Central's Extreme Weather Toolkit take it a step further. They use plain language to explain that a community isn't just going to slowly sink. They explain how a rising baseline sea level acts as a launch pad for storm surges and high tides.
That is a crucial function of these tools, because a rising sea level is a threat multiplier. A storm surge that used to be a once-in-a-century catastrophe becomes a decade-level event simply because the water started from a higher baseline.
Right.
But we have to return to that terrifying March 2026 AP and Guardian study we discussed in the beginning, the revelation that our historical models have underestimated real-world sea levels.
Right, because if our fundamental models have been wrong, how reliable are these incredibly detailed interactive maps? Are we building massive, multi-billion-dollar coastal defenses based on outdated, flawed blueprints?
The vulnerability in the models primarily stems from the elevation data on the ground.
Yeah.
To predict where the water will go, you need highly accurate, high-resolution topographical maps of the coastline. In North America and Europe, we have excellent laser-mapped elevation data. But in vast areas of the Global South and the Indo-Pacific, the maps historically relied on less accurate satellite radar that often mistook the tops of dense tree canopies or buildings for the actual ground level.
Ah, I see. So the satellite model thought the physical ground was, say, 2 meters above sea level because it was bouncing off the roof of a house or a mangrove forest, when in reality, the actual dirt was only half a meter above the water.
Exactly. If your map of the physical ground is off by even a meter, your projection of who gets flooded is catastrophically wrong. When scientists corrected those elevation models, they found that millions more people were already living in extreme vulnerability. Furthermore, the physics models themselves are constantly being updated to reflect new discoveries, like the warm water intrusions beneath Antarctica.
So it's a moving target.
It is. To reduce this uncertainty, institutions like the British Antarctic Survey are running massive initiatives like the Ocean Ice Project. They are combining brand new on-the-ground field observations from the Antarctic grounding lines with incredibly complex new supercomputer models. They're trying to refine the math of the ice melt before the water arrives.
But the ultimate takeaway from those 2026 underestimations is that adaptation strategies must be built with extreme flexibility. A digital flood line on a city planner's map is not a permanent guarantee. It is the best science we have right now, but the reality is that the water may arrive faster and push further inland than the digital models suggest.
And this shifts our focus from the theoretical space of digital maps and satellite gravity models to the visceral human reality on the ground. Because the data we are discussing is no longer an abstraction. It is manifesting as daily, tangible, and often brutal crises for communities across the globe right now.
That brings us to the front lines of the crisis. Looking closely at the impact, the most insidious phase of this isn't a city being wiped off the map by a massive tsunami. The first wave of true disruption is something called sunny day flooding.
Right, also known as nuisance flooding or high tide flooding. This occurs when the baseline sea level has risen so much that a routine high tide, not a hurricane, not a tropical storm, just a normal astronomical tide, is enough to push water into human environments.
A June 2025 Washington Post report highlighted this phenomenon devastating coastal North Carolina. It is a beautiful, sunny Tuesday afternoon, not a cloud in the sky, and suddenly the streets are impassable, filled with a foot of salt water. How is the water getting past the defenses without a storm?
It is about the plumbing of the coast. When the baseline sea level is higher, the ocean essentially exerts immense hydrostatic pressure against the land. When the high tide rolls in, the water doesn't just come over the seawalls, it forces its way backward up through the municipal storm drain systems.
Oh.
Yeah, it pushes up through the porous coastal soil, bubbling up through the pavement and flooding basements from below. The infrastructure of these towns was engineered for a sea level that fundamentally no longer exists.
And when you combine that elevated baseline with actual weather, the results are paralyzing. A January 2026 Associated Press report detailed extreme king tides in California that coincided with heavy rainstorms. People were literally getting trapped in their cars on flooded coastal roads.
That California scenario is what hydrologists call a compound flooding event. You have heavy rainfall over the land trying to drain down rivers and municipal pipes into the ocean. But because the sea level is exceptionally high due to the king tide, the ocean acts like a wall. It pushes back. The rain has nowhere to go, so it backs up and floods the city. It creates a hydrological traffic jam.
Which brings up a massive, glaring contradiction in how our society is reacting to this. We have this undeniable physical reality of the water invading our infrastructure, and yet the economic machine keeps churning as if the map is permanent. We see this intense tension playing out vividly in coastal real estate.
The psychology and economics of risk in these zones are deeply contradictory. Let's look at the juxtaposition of two events from June of 2026.
Right. On one hand, you have a New York Post article detailing yet another beachfront home collapsing entirely into the Atlantic Ocean in Buxton, North Carolina, on the Outer Banks. This isn't an isolated incident and has become a recurring theme. The house is just gone, the foundation swept away by coastal erosion and rising surf. The physical land the house is built on simply ceased to exist.
And yet, on the very same day, an Inside Climate news story reported on the political situation in New Jersey. The state agreed to delay the implementation of stricter coastal building rules. These proposed rules were designed to require new shore homes to be elevated much higher above current flood levels, specifically to account for the accelerating sea level rise projections we've discussed.
So we have undeniable viral footage of houses falling into the ocean just down the coast, and simultaneously, the political and economic pressure from property developers and local tax boards is strong enough to successfully delay logical climate adaptation. Why are we still building in the red zones?
Well, it comes down to short-term economic incentives completely overwhelming long-term risk assessment. Coastal real estate is astronomically valuable. It is a massive driver of municipal tax revenue, which funds local schools and services.
Right.
For a developer or a local politician, the immediate financial incentive to build, sell, and tax a waterfront property right now outweighs the abstract scientific reality that the property might be underwater in 20 or 30 years. The entire economic engine relies on a collective agreement to ignore the shifting map.
But for millions of people around the world, pretending the map hasn't changed is no longer an option. The era of adaptation building seawalls or elevating houses has already failed them. They have reached the point where retreat is the only viable choice. And the logistics of organized relocation are absolutely brutal. We are not talking about packing up a moving truck. We are talking about uprooting entire societies and cultures.
The human cost of this retreat is staggering, and it is happening right now. The sources provided give us specific, agonizing case studies. In mid-2024, the Associated Press reported on the Guna families of Gardisug-Dub in Panama. This is an indigenous community living on a densely populated, low-lying Caribbean island.
The island had become fundamentally unsafe. They were facing relentless annual flooding that was destroying their homes and sanitation. So in 2024, they began the painful process of physically abandoning their island and moving into newly built houses on the Panamanian mainland.
It is a stark modern example of a government-backed organized retreat. But even when the retreat is organized, the cultural severing from ancestral land is devastating. We see a similarly protracted struggle in the Arctic. The native village of Nutok in Alaska has been undergoing a harrowing relocation to a new site called Murtarvik.
The situation in Alaska is a perfect storm of climate impacts. It isn't just the rising sea level. It is the loss of coastal sea ice that used to buffer the shore from winter storms, combined with the thawing of the permafrost, the permanently frozen ground the village was built on. The land is literally melting and washing away into the Bering Sea. And the relocation process has been agonizingly slow and piecemeal because the community has to constantly fight for inadequate federal climate funding.
The vulnerability in these Arctic communities is immediate and life-threatening. An AP report from October 2025 highlighted how a typhoon remnant swept into coastal Alaska, washing away homes and forcing emergency mass airlifts of residents from low-lying areas. And this vulnerability extends down the Pacific coast.
In May 2024, reports detailed the struggle of the Quinault Indian Nation in Washington state. They are working desperately to relocate the lower village of Tohola to higher ground because storm surges, supercharged by a rising baseline sea level, are pushing massive waves and salt water directly into people's yards and critical infrastructure.
And if we look globally, the situation in West Africa illustrates the loss of ancient livelihoods. A Le Monde report from late 2025 described the existential crisis facing San Luis, Senegal. This historic, beautiful coastal city is being squeezed from multiple sides. They are facing rising seas, eroding their beaches, massive river flooding pushing from the interior, and subsidence causing the city to sink.
The fishermen in St. Louis are losing their homes and their livelihoods. The physical space required to launch boats and process fish is being reclaimed by the Atlantic. But arguably, the communities on the most fragile front lines of all are the Pacific Island nations.
Reuters reports from Fiji detail the agonizing choices facing residents of places like Sarua Island. The seawater now routinely floods their gardens and pathways at high tide. They are facing the deeply painful choice of abandoning their ancestral lands, the graves of their ancestors, and their traditional way of life to move to the main island.
And there is a profound geopolitical tension here. Fiji, as a nation, is demanding that the high-emitting industrialized countries of the global north pay the massive logistical and economic costs for this relocation, because the communities in Fiji, or the Guna families in Panama, contributed statistically zero to the greenhouse gas emissions that are causing the thermal expansion and the Antarctic ice melt.
It is a massive issue of climate justice. The communities paying the absolute highest physical and cultural price are the ones least responsible for the shifting map.
It forces us to ask a profound question about the concept of home. We are seeing that when the water arrives, we don't just lose physical houses. We lose communities, localized economies, and irreplaceable histories. But the physical loss of the land is only the most visible symptom. As the ocean pushes inward, it triggers a cascade of hidden crises that the public is largely blind to. The water doesn't just sit on the land. It fundamentally alters the chemistry and viability of everything it touches.
This brings us to the unseen ripples of sea level rise. We must examine the severe impacts on global health, the contamination of food systems, and the literal erasure of human heritage. Let's begin with the health crisis, because this is a secondary impact that operates almost entirely out of sight until it is too late. An April 2026 Guardian report detailed how rising baseline sea levels are quietly devastating sanitation systems, leading to the rampant spread of waterborne diseases in coastal slums.
But the most alarming public health data came from a May 2024 report by Global Health and NOW focusing on coastal Bangladesh. They described a phenomenon that is acting as a silent killer in the region's saltwater intrusion.
Saltwater intrusion is a devastating chemical shift. As the physical weight and volume of the ocean increase, it exerts greater hydrostatic pressure against the coastal land masses. This pressure physically forces dense, saline ocean water deep into the underground coastal aquifers and groundwater systems that humans rely on.
So the salt water is infiltrating the municipal wells and the groundwater. In Bangladesh, this salinity is fundamentally contaminating the drinking water supply for millions of people. And the health impact of consuming highly saline water every single day is catastrophic.
The human body is not equipped to process that level of continuous salt intake. The report highlighted how this saltwater intrusion is driving a massive spike in widespread hypertension, high blood pressure across coastal populations. And crucially, it is disproportionately impacting women's health, causing severe life-threatening complications during pregnancy.
It is a slow-motion public health emergency. The ocean isn't drowning them with a wave. It is slowly poisoning their biology from the inside out. It is like an autoimmune disease for the planet. The sea level rise isn't just a surface wound. It's the ocean's salt getting into the bloodstream of our environment. And that contamination extends to our industrial legacy as well.
Absolutely. A November 2025 investigation by the Associated Press cross-referenced flood projection maps with the locations of thousands of hazardous waste sites across the United States. They found a terrifying number of these sites are at extreme risk of coastal flooding.
We are talking about old chemical manufacturing plants, decommissioned industrial facilities, Superfund sites, and toxic waste dumps. These facilities were built decades ago, engineered for a mid-20th century sea level.
When the water rises and inundates these sites, it doesn't just flood them. It mobilizes the toxic chemicals, the heavy metals, and the carcinogens stored there. There's a massive looming threat of these hazardous materials being washed out into local communities, contaminating soil and devastating marine ecosystems.
And the salt water doesn't just threaten industry, it threatens our ability to feed ourselves. The Environmental and Energy Study Institute noted that saltwater intrusion is actively jeopardizing America's coastal agricultural lands. When saltwater pushes up through the soil, it physically changes the soil chemistry, literally salting the earth so that traditional crops simply cannot grow.
And we see this agricultural threat playing out on a civilization-altering scale in Southeast Asia. A late 2025 Le Monde report focused on Vietnam's Mekong Delta. This is one of the most vital, productive agricultural regions on the planet, responsible for producing massive amounts of rice that feed millions globally.
The Mekong Delta is facing a brutal convergence of issues. It is a river delta, so it is naturally composed of soft sediment. And because of massive groundwater extraction for agriculture and growing cities, the entire delta is rapidly subsiding. It is sinking.
Exactly. So the land is dropping, the sea level is rising, and the salt water is pushing miles inland, infiltrating the intricate network of canals and rice paddies. Rice is highly sensitive to salinity. If the Mekong Delta becomes too salty to farm, the food security implications are staggering. The ripple effects will cause massive disruptions in global commodity markets and trigger widespread economic instability.
Beyond our physical survival, our drinking water, our health, and our food, the rising ocean is also attacking our connection to the past. It is erasing human heritage. We are losing the physical evidence of our ancestors before we can even fully see it. An August 2025 AP report warned that the iconic Moai statues on Easter Island, those massive ancient stone faces, are facing severe risk from rising seas and increasingly powerful wave action by 2080.
And we see a different, more insidious type of destruction in ancient urban centers. A Reuters piece from July 2025 examined the crisis in Alexandria, Egypt. The destruction there perfectly illustrates the hidden subterranean impacts of the shifting map. Alexandria is not just facing the threat of waves crashing over a seawall, the city is being attacked from below.
Let's explain the mechanics of that because it is fascinating and tragic. How does the ocean destroy a city from underneath?
It involves the interaction of salt water and porous stone, specifically limestone, which is common in ancient foundations. As the sea level rises, the local water table rises with it. Salt water is pushed up into the soil beneath the city. This salt water then wicks up into the porous foundations of ancient ruins and modern buildings alike through capillary action.
So the salty water soaks up into the stone like a sponge.
Yes. And when the water inevitably evaporates out of the stone, it leaves the salt molecules behind. These salt crystals form inside the microscopic pores of the rock, and as they crystallize, they expand. This expansion exerts immense internal pressure, physically blowing the stone apart from the inside. It is a process called salt weathering.
So the rising sea is literally turning the foundations of Alexandria to dust. Residents are dealing with cracking, shifting, and tilting structures because the ground they stand on is losing its structural integrity.
It is a devastating loss. And Carbon Brief mapped out African World Heritage sites, projecting that the number of highly significant coastal sites threatened by sea level rise and coastal erosion will triple by 2050. The physical anchors of human history are being washed away.
And, of course, underpinning all of this loss, the collapsing health systems, the ruined agriculture, the crumbling history, is a staggering, almost incomprehensible economic toll.
The financial context requires us to think in completely different magnitudes. A late 2025 Carbon Brief report estimated that under current climate policies, the Asia-Pacific region alone faces potential economic damages from sea level rise, approaching $500 billion a year by the year 2100. Global flood losses are skyrocketing annually because we have placed our most valuable dense infrastructure right on the edge of a rapidly shifting map.
Okay, listening to all of this, the salt water rotting the foundations of Alexandria, the Mekong Delta losing its ability to grow rice, hundreds of billions of dollars in economic damage, I have to ask the question that always comes up. Humans are the ultimate engineers. We built the Panama Canal. We built the Hoover Dam. Can't we just build better defenses? Can't we just pour enough concrete, build massive seawalls, and physically hold the ocean back?
It is a deeply ingrained human instinct to want to build a fortress to fight nature. And engineering certainly plays a role in protecting critical, dense urban centers. But we are rapidly discovering the harsh physical limits of concrete. We cannot simply build a wall around every coastline on Earth. What is fascinating is the growing realization that we need to pivot toward nature-based solutions, often referred to as blue carbon initiatives.
Let's define blue carbon in this context. Usually when we talk about carbon, we are talking about emissions.
Blue carbon generally refers to the carbon sequestered by the world's oceanic and coastal ecosystems. But in the context of coastal defense, it means actively restoring and protecting natural barriers like mangrove forests, vast salt marshes, and seagrass meadows. These biological systems act as phenomenal natural shock absorbers.
How do they outperform a concrete wall?
A flat concrete wall reflects wave energy, which often causes extreme erosion right at the base of the wall, eventually undermining it. But a dense mangrove forest or a salt marsh absorbs and dissipates the kinetic energy of a storm surge. Their intricate root systems bind the soil together, preventing erosion, and the wetlands themselves can absorb massive volumes of excess water far more effectively than rigid municipal drainage.
A Vox article from September 2024 provided a brilliant example of this. It highlighted the Shinnecock Nation on Long Island, New York. They are actively utilizing these nature-based methods to protect their tribal lands. They aren't trying to build a concrete fortress to fight the rising waters of the Hamptons. Instead, they're building massive oyster reefs and restoring coastal wetlands. They're essentially employing nature's own engineering to buffer the waves and stabilize their shores.
It is a profound shift from fighting the water to working dynamically with it. But we must also be realistic about the absolute limits of any human intervention, whether it's concrete or nature-based, when the scale of the planetary shift becomes too immense. The clearest, most heartbreaking example of this came from Louisiana in July 2025.
The Washington Post reported heavily on that. The state of Louisiana officially scrapped the Mid-Barataria Sediment Diversion Project. This was supposed to be a crowning achievement of coastal restoration.
It was a massive $3 billion engineering endeavor. The project was scientifically sound historically. The Mississippi River naturally overflowed its banks, depositing massive amounts of sediment that built and sustained the wetlands of the Louisiana coast. But when humans built massive levees to control the river for shipping and flood protection, they starved the wetlands of that sediment, causing the coast to rapidly sink and erode into the Gulf of Mexico.
So the plan was to basically punch a controlled hole in the Mississippi River levee, divert the sediment-rich water into the dying Barataria Basin, and artificially rebuild the natural wetlands to act as a buffer against sea level rise.
Exactly. It was a massive attempt to use nature-based solutions powered by human engineering, but it was ultimately canceled. The project faced spiraling costs, but more importantly, it faced intense, intractable conflicts regarding its immediate secondary impacts, specifically on the local economy.
Because if you dump millions of gallons of fresh river water into a highly saline, brackish bay, you fundamentally alter the local ecology. The sudden influx of fresh water would have devastated the local commercial oyster beds and impacted marine life like dolphins that rely on that specific salinity.
It pitted the long-term survival of the coastline against the immediate economic survival of the local fishing communities. It illustrates that even when we possess the engineering knowledge, the scientific understanding, and a multi-billion dollar budget, the sheer logistical, ecological, and political complexity of fighting the ocean can render a project impossible. We cannot simply build our way out of the problem everywhere. At a certain point, the ocean's persistent advance wins the battle of attrition.
And that realization is profound. It forces a complete paradigm shift from trying to dominate the water to adapting to its permanent presence, which, as we explored with Panama and Alaska, often means making the excruciating choice to retreat. This has been an incredibly intense, dense journey through the data. Let's synthesize exactly what we have uncovered in this deep dive.
We began by unpacking the fundamental physics driving the shifting map. We looked at the invisible kinetic energy of warming oceans causing massive thermal expansion and the staggering transfer of mass as mountain glaciers and polar ice sheets melt. Crucially, we explored the newly discovered tipping points, like warm ocean water infiltrating deep beneath the bedrock grounding lines of Antarctica, accelerating the collapse from below.
We tracked the terrifying acceleration of this entire process, confronting the 2026 UN warning that the rate of global sea level rise has doubled in just the last decade, completely outpacing older conservative climate models. We explored how the ocean is not a bathtub, but a complex aerodynamic system driven by shifting currents, sinking land, and the mind-bending reality of ice sheet gravity.
We looked at the highly sophisticated tool satellites measuring microscopic gravitational anomalies from space that scientists use to build predictive models, while acknowledging that these digital maps must remain flexible as our understanding of the physical ground elevation improves.
And finally, we brought all of that abstract planetary physics down to the deeply human, immediate realities on the ground. We moved from satellite data to the collapsed beachfront homes in North Carolina, the agonizing logistics of displacing indigenous communities in the Arctic and the Pacific, the silent, slow-motion health crisis of saltwater intrusion, poisoning wells in Bangladesh, and the literal crumbling of human heritage in places like Alexandria.
The central realization is that sea level rise is not a monolithic, futuristic event. It is a highly variable, aerodynamic process that is actively compounding with human-driven land subsidence to aggressively rewrite the geography of our present moment.
And this is exactly why it matters to you, the listener. You might live 1,000 miles from the nearest coastline. You might think this is an issue solely for people who bought beachfront property. But the ripple effects of this violently shifting map are going to reach you. When the Mekong Delta loses its ability to grow rice due to saltwater intrusion, global food security shifts and commodity prices spike. When hundreds of billions of dollars of coastal real estate, chemical plants, and port infrastructure are threatened or destroyed, the global economy absorbs a massive shockwave.
When entire communities or entire nations are displaced by relentless sunny day flooding, ruined agriculture, or toxic contamination, the patterns of human migration change fundamentally. The geopolitical stability of regions will be tested as populations are forced inland. It requires a mental shift from seeing sea level rise as a niche environmental issue saving the polar bears or preserving a tourist beach to recognizing it as a central, load-bearing pillar of 21st century global economics, public health, and human geography.
The map is fluid. The foundation is shifting. And our entire civilization is stubbornly built on the assumption that the lines drawn on that map are fixed. And that leaves us with a final, lingering thought to mull over, building on the existential plight of the Pacific Islands we mentioned earlier. The nation of Tuvalu is actively fighting in international courts to maintain its legally recognized maritime boundaries, its lucrative fishing rights, and its sovereign identity as a state, even in the event that its physical landmass becomes completely submerged by the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
If international law drafted centuries ago ties a nation's resources, its identity, and its very right to exist to a physical piece of rock sitting above the water. Wait, I can't even formulate that properly without realizing how bizarre it is. What happens to global geopolitics when a sovereign nation becomes entirely aquatic? If a country exists only on legal documents and in the hearts of a displaced diaspora spread across the globe, who owns the ocean they were forced to leave behind?
It is a question without precedent. It challenges the very bedrock of how human beings define a nation, and it proves that the rising water isn't just erasing the coastlines, it is erasing the old rules of the world.
It is the ultimate muddying of the waters. We are going to have to redraw a lot more than just the maps. Until next time, keep diving deep.